Welcome to a Rapid Reaction podcast with me, Alistair Benn, Deputy Editor of Reaction, and Ian Martin, Editor of Reaction. Today we're going to talk about the reshuffle. Ian, your thoughts?
Well, what was supposed to be a fairly undramatic reshuffle, there's been a lot of hype in the months since the election, but it had seemed to be the case that all the big players were going to stay in place, all of the top three jobs, was then blown up by the extraordinary news that the Chancellor had resigned at about 10 to 12 on reshuffle day. Now, there are various ways to read that. If you are a friend of Dom Cummings or an ally of Dominic Cummings, the Prime Minister's chief advisor, you can present this as the culmination of a brilliant strategy to get what you always wanted, which is the removal of Sajid Javid as Chancellor and replacing him with Rishi Sunak, who is Cummings' idea of a bold, dynamic choice, or you could say someone who's like to be a bit more compliant. Or you can take the alternative view, which is that is a ludicrous way to present things, that losing a Chancellor on reshuffle day in that fashion in front of the markets is tin pot and embarrassing. And I know there have been lots of tensions between number 10 and number 11, but I can't really conceive that Boris Johnson woke up on reshuffle day thinking or hoping that the position that he and Cummings had put Javid in would result in his resignation. But it happened for reasons we can explore a bit on this podcast, mainly because there has been so much tension in the run-up to the budget, and Cummings and Boris had attempted to effectively get Javid to accept that all of his advisers would be fired and that the Treasury would operate much more under the control of number 10, which is, I think, a very bad idea.
And the enmity goes back some way between Javid and Cummings, to the summer at least.
Yes, it does. It is born of a feeling that Javid is insufficiently ambitious or bold in Boris and Cummings' terms, and the relationship really just broke down. There was also the dynamic around the Tory leadership contest, where of course Javid had run and had actually run a rather good campaign. I don't think it's that they would see Javid as, or the team Cummings would see Javid as, a direct threat to the Prime Minister, because Johnson is unchallengeable. He's the most successful, in electoral terms, he's the most successful Tory leader since Thatcher in 87. So it's not so much that, it's not a Blair Brown thing that Javid was going to replace Boris, but Cummings likes compliance and he likes people to sign up to his agenda, which is curiously, is he's not that interested in economics.
Hmm.
Which should trouble people. Economics is something which he thinks can be subordinated to other concerns. You see that with the referendum. It's also something he doesn't, in his blogs, he doesn't theorise that much about. So he's not a student of economics. Neither's Boris.
Mm.
I mean, they both take a view that with confidence and great initiatives and some verve and innovation, you'll get a booming economy and then do interesting things with it. So to them, Javid would be just regarded as a bit boring, a bit dry, not imaginative enough. I think that's unfair. And this grudge match started between Javid and Cummings, with the claim being on the part of Javid that actually the relationship with Boris was okay, but just not with Cummings. But that turns out not to be the case.
Well, yeah, we know that Cummings sort of recommends everyone reads the great 19th century novels as a way of getting to know about politics. But can you give some picture of how the relationship between the Treasury and the number 10 and number 10 will be reshaped around this, what they're calling the number 10, number 11 economic unit?
Yeah, the signs are not good. If you look at the history of this, Now, there are some stray examples, there are some interesting examples in the 19th century of particularly strong economic prime ministers. But broadly in the modern era, it has been the case that it goes very badly wrong when number 10 or a prime minister thinks that they can run the economy or boss the treasury. History is littered with examples of that going badly wrong, or you look at the conflicts conflicts and cooperation between Callaghan and Healey, for example, or the complete meltdown and breakdown which ended up leading to the fall of Margaret Thatcher with Lawson. And remember, the direct cause, the underlying cause, was Europe and the Bruges speech and her opposition to single European currency, about which she was absolutely right, by the way. But Lawson's problem was that she had an economic advisor, Alan Walters, and he thought that she was trying to minimise the role of the Treasury and run a shadow economic policy, or really boss the Treasury. And it, as I said, it ended up blowing up the government. Blair and Brown's a different sort of tension, and very interesting in the way in which they fought, but they also collaborated and cooperated. And they provided, because you had within one government, you had the government and the opposition, you had Blair as Prime Minister and Brown wanting to be Prime Minister, that became the whole story, so the Tories really couldn't get a look in. So that, there's a different dynamic. It's different this time, of course, but it just isn't really credible, the idea that from a desk in number 10 that you can run the Treasury, particularly when they're trying to, number 10 it seems, is they're trying to get much more hands-on control of the NHS, which I think is something that is not sensible to attempt, and they want more direct control of transport policy as well. So you can see what they want. They want the levers of power, and Boris is frustrated because he's pulling the levers and
to get not there you've response. Got to sort of bypass things like the lobby or all these kind of traditional,
yes, that's
what they see as breaks on that agenda, or anti-transformative agenda.
Yes,
but that breaks down if you have, you know, a black swan event like, well, coronavirus messing up global supply chains,
or the financial crisis in 2007, exactly. 2008, where when Brown came to office as Prime Minister, he appointed Alistair Darling, thinking, assuming wrongly, and classic Gordon Brown misreading human nature, thinking that Alistair Darling would be just a patsy and do as he was instructed by number 10. So he'd appointed, as he saw it, a friend and a subordinate. Well, Alistair Darling rightly took the view that he was the Chancellor and he had serious concerns about what was happening to the global economy, and he started talking frankly about it and in a constructive fashion. What happened then was that when the crisis broke, and at one point Brown was going to get rid of Darling and replace him with Ed Balls, but the crisis breaks, and Darling then becomes a big figure in his own right and unfireable by Brown, because he needs Darling's reassurance and, you know, calmness in the line of fire to manage the crisis, and they end up doing it together. I think and managing that process with joint press conferences, and together they fight off the worst of the crisis. I think it all illustrates there is no perfectible model for number 10 and number 11 working together, but there must always be, even in a decent relationship or in a government where things are being achieved, there has to be a tension, because the two institutions are in balance, or need to be in balance, because they are there to do different things.
Yeah.
So the office of Prime Minister and machinery of number 10 exists to do a lot of things in war and peace, but it exists in Boris' world to spend money, to open things, to launch grand projects, to unleash national dynamism, and to be exciting and popular and win elections. The Treasury exists really to guard the public finances, and there are endless arguments about what is the best way to guard the public finances. Sometimes the interests of the two institutions overlap, and they work together as they did during the financial crisis with Brown and Darling. Other times they don't align, but you have to you have to have that tension. Otherwise, you have if you have too much of it, you have dysfunction, like you had under Blair and Brown. Eventually, where Britain left it was left badly exposed because of weaknesses in the banking system, which developed in large part because Brown was too focused on his war with Blair. So if you get dysfunction at that level, you store up problems. And if you have a weak and supine chancellor, they're insufficiently equipped to then defend the public, to defend the public finances.
And the move kind of shorts that relationship and completely reorientates it.
It does, but then there are... just come over from Westminster, won't say it's recess, but there's still lots of people obviously hanging around drinking, gossiping and trying to work out what's going on. But it can be read one of two ways, the appointment of Javid's successor. You could read it as this makes the Chancellor more powerful than any Chancellor has been for a long time because he becomes unfireable, because you can't then lose another Chancellor in 6 months down the line. I'm not even sure that's true, actually. I mean, such is the way that the Johnson administration operates. You can break all sorts of precedent. But so there's that theory that he can stake out a position as, look, I'm Boris's man, but I'm also going to develop my own agenda. Or there is the view which says, well, this is a pathetic way for a serious country to behave because the Chancellor, the finance minister, a serious figure in international global markets and among his contemporaries around the world, is someone who's effectively there on license, not allowed to appoint his own advisors, and has to comply with the chief advisor in number 10, who's, as I said earlier, not really that interested in economics. So read it whichever way you want to. To read it. There's also a social mobility angle to it. There's, you know, Wickhamist Chancellor, someone who married the daughter of a billionaire, has replaced a comprehensive boy, and I would say poster boy for social mobility, Sajid Javid. Whether you like what he did as Chancellor or not, he's clearly a very serious figure who has been treated pretty badly, I would have thought, today.
Is there a way back for Javid?
I doubt it very much, but then that opens up the question of what his resignation speech will be like. Will he hope for some other form of international appointment out of the Boris administration? I doubt it very much. I think the relationship is at an end. So his speech will be quite punchy. There are a lot of people on the back benches. I've written about this for the Times for Friday. There's now quite a collection of Tory big beasts or former big beasts on the back benches who will be, I think, quite robust in terms of speaking out about Cummings or when the government hits problems.
Is the what are your thoughts on Rishi Sunak? Beyond, he's a Wickhamist. And two, I saw that it's being reported that the government is refusing to confirm that it will stick to its fiscal rules, which rather confirms your notion that the spending tax will be.
There's a curiosity here with him. He's a very impressive media performer, which is why the Tories put him up during the election for the debates, if you remember, or for one of the debates. So he's ultra confident, always smiling, clearly sort of trained for power. Beyond that surface level confidence, I colour me sceptical. I think if you look at the preparation that people tend to go through for being Chancellor, if you look at the the work that Gordon Brown did before he became Chancellor. Not enough, as it turns out, but Gordon Brown, or you think of Lawson's preparation through The Spectator and through writing and thinking very deeply about economics, there was a worldview and a vision there, both with Lawson and with Brown. With Darling, you had him, he'd done many of the most difficult jobs in Whitehall and done them pretty effectively and survived some nightmare jobs. And while he wasn't an economic animal initially, he adapted to the job very well and was the right person at the right time in a crisis. Osborne's a slightly different, more complex case, but he had been Shadow Chancellor for a long time and worked very closely with Cameron. You could argue that there's an example of Cameron and Osborne ran an unusual operation where there was real closeness between number 10 and number 11, but there were still fights and they'd had a long time in opposition to build that.
Yeah.
And they were friends as well as rivals. On Sunak, the question is going to be whether the taps are turned on. So was it the case that Javid was prepared to just spend as Boris wants?
Yeah.
And is the expectation now that the new Chancellor will just give him what he wants, as much borrowing as is required and few tax rises and hope for the best? But
imaginative part of my brain thinks maybe he's appointed his greatest foe. He's such an unknown quantity, as you see now. He never run a significant office of state. Maybe he'll become a great the next Tory psychodrama.
Well, it could be. You're right. I mean, one of the reaction team got in touch with me as soon as he heard this and said exactly that. Mm. Said, hasn't he just by accident ended up with the next Tory leader in as Chancellor, and Sunak is, barring disaster, pretty unfireable. That was his view. So this ends up not working out. I don't know.
The same background as Emmanuel Macron in Anglo-American terms.
Yeah, I mean, I sound like I'm being a chippy comprehensive boy, but I'm not knocking great schools. You know, even Wickhamists have a place in public life. I'm not suggesting otherwise. Yeah. But no, I mentioned that on the Sajid Javid thing because it is clearly something that that was a Javid strength, that he was an example of social mobility, and he's now not the Chancellor. But we'll see. This is a rapid reaction podcast, so I think we're going to wrap it up now, and we're going to go back and put out loads of stuff on the site, which your subscribers will get in their evening email from Alistair, and then we'll be back with a full longer edition of the Reaction podcast early next week, I think. But thank you for listening.